Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's morning show, we're going to be taken back to the dramatic final weeks of the Second World War, as experienced through the eyes of a fictional German family, a mother, a father, and their two sons, trying to hold it together as everything around them falls apart. The novel is called The Vanishing Sky, and it's written by a talented and award-winning writer by the name of L. Annette Binder. L. Annette Binder was actually born in Germany herself. And the events of this novel and of the family at the heart of this novel are drawn at least in part by what she imagines her own father experienced as a young man during the Second World War. Sadly, L. Annette Binder's father died when she was just 16 years old, before they were ever able to have any extensive conversation about what he experienced during his youth. But L. Annette Binder was able to uncover a remarkable amount of information about her father in those years, and she has drawn upon that information to craft this breathtakingly beautiful and moving novel. It's published by Bloomsbury. Again, it's titled The Vanishing Sky. So in the information that was included with the book, this is what it says. When I first started work on my novel, meaning The Vanishing Sky, I came across a photograph of my father taken in 1944. He is wearing a Hitler Youth uniform in the photo. I had not known he had been in the Hitler Youth. But given that service was compulsory for most boys by the end of the war, I should not have been surprised. There's a lot tied up in that right there. So first of all, explain how you were, if I understand correctly, already at work on this novel before you had learned this intriguing fact about your own father.
That's right, Greg. I had started, and I was only about two chapters in when I decided that I was going to snoop around a little bit and try to find out more about my own family. I had come to the U.S. when I was 5 and a half, and my parents had never really spoken to me about their time in Germany, about their childhoods in particular, during the war. And so I came across a photo album that I had not looked at before, and the final photograph in the album from my father's childhood was this photograph of him wearing his Hitler Youth uniform. And something about the expression in his eyes really just pulled me in. The change between his earlier years, where he was a rambunctious, mischievous-looking little boy, and the very solemn, almost sorrowful 14-year-old that I saw just pulled me in, and I realized there was another character in this family that I was writing about, a younger boy who's also in the Hitler Youth. And somehow my father's photograph became almost like a gateway to meeting this other character and finding out about him.
Wow. You go on to say in this information included with your book, my father died when I was 16 without ever having told me about his early life. His silence seemed perfectly normal at the time. So in other words, you found this out about your father after he was already gone, and there was no way to engage with him in any kind of conversations and find out more about this.
That's right. That's right. He passed away when I was 16. He died of cancer, and he had about 4 months from diagnosis to when he passed away. So there would have been a 4-month window for me to ask questions of him about his life. And at 16, I just did not have, I don't know, the sort of thoughtfulness to to ask him about his life and his experiences.
Hmm. So tell us what you did in terms of wanting to find out more about your father and this chapter of his life after he was already gone. To what lengths did you go in terms of trying to understand this facet of your father a bit more?
Well, the first person I went to was my mom, who was younger than my father. She would have only been about five at the end of World War II. But my father had told her many things during the course of their marriage. And so I spent countless hours talking to my mom in person or over the phone to find out what my father had told her about his life and that of his older brother who served on the Eastern Front. And so I learned much about him that way. I learned that he tried to run away from his post in the Hitler Youth, which is also what the character in my book does, that he really struggled to live up to the expectations of his father, who was the head school teacher in this small town in southern Germany, and he had very high expectations for both of his sons. And my father, unlike his older brother, really struggled and rebelled, which is in character. My father, as serious as he was and as sort of introverted as he was also a bit of a prankster and, rebelled against, I think, authority in that way. So I learned a lot from my mom. His younger sister was just a baby at the end of World War II, but she went through the trouble of transcribing her grandfather, my father's grandfather's journals from between the wars. And so I really got an amazing insight into life in this small town and the sort of petty feuds that could erupt, sort of the tragedies that happened in his life and also the sort of happy moments and the sort of trivial things that made up his day-to-day life, and also how Germany was disintegrating between the wars, how the economy was just tanking, and, you know, everything that we hear about needing a wagon full of currency to buy a loaf of bread was exactly right. And luckily, my great-grandfather was a sort of fastidious man, and so he kept track of the rising prices, showing how much a roll went up over the years, starting with like a few pennies to being millions of marks. And so all of those sources were incredibly helpful. I found some documentation from my father's childhood, including the racial purity notebook that he had to keep, showing no Jewish ancestry in his family going all the way back to 1819. And that was probably one of the most chilling things that I found. And it stayed with me as I wrote the sort of wondering what it was like to live in this regime, this murderous regime, where you had to trace your ancestry in that way. And if something came up in any of the documentation, the consequences would be that you would be rounded up and taken away and murdered. So all of these things found their way into the book and helped me imagine what it might have been like to live under a regime like this.
Hmm. You tell us that you read a number of books that had been written about this period, about the Hitler Youth Organization and so on. And you tell us that at some point the face of your father, I mean, as a young boy staring at you from that photograph, in a sense almost provoked you, rebuked you. It's time to write the book now. But one gets a sense that you could have spent the rest of your life just exploring this without ever having sat down and actually penning the book itself that you needed to write.
That's right. I think research is very seductive because it's so interesting and it leads through all these other tunnels, to unexpected places, and the stories are so compelling. And at a certain level, you have to let that go, and you have to listen to your own characters and sort of explore where they are and where they're going to lead you. And so when I wrote without an outline, and it was really just spending day in, day out with this family, and they always surprised me. I always learned something new about them, and I really felt, strange as it sounds, like they were leading me through the book.
Hmm. We're speaking with L. Annette Binder, and we're talking about her novel, The Vanishing Sky, which is set in Germany in the waning months of the Second World War. And as Germany disintegrates under Allied attack, we are talking about what this means for a certain German family, a mother, father, and two sons, and what they are experiencing. And as you've just heard, much of this is drawn heavily from Elinette Binder's own family and her own father in particular, and some of his experiences. Tell us more about what you learned about this Hitler Youth organization. How long was it in existence, and how did the nature of this organization change as Germany's fortunes in the Second World War began to disintegrate so alarmingly?
Yes, the Hitler Youth was an incredibly powerful tool for the regime to indoctrinate young boys. I mean, there was an equivalent sort of group for girls as well. It started, there was a version for younger boys, and then once they were 14, they graduated to the Hitler Youth. And it was really a way, I think, of separating children from their parents and from any other authority, any other moral authority that might exert a sort of countervailing influence in their lives. And so it started as sort of a scouting organization. It sort of supplanted any other organizations for youth that were in place in the 20s and early 30s. And by the time my father came of age, he was born in 1930, it had really become compulsory for almost every boy in Germany to be part of the Hitler Youth. And it was, it emphasized physical fitness. It emphasized the regime's sort of racist and murderous ideology, but it really did not talk about the final solution in a direct way. Everything that I've read about the Hitler Youth from first-person accounts suggests that the sort of the murderous goals were not discussed overtly. It was much more sort of the racial ideology that was emphasized, the inherent superiority of the Aryans, and you know, the inferiority of all other racial groups, the importance of defending the country against these other racial groups and against enemies both inside, you know, internal and external. And by the end of the war, when Germany's fortunes had really taken a turn for the worse, the Hitler Youth became yet another sort of last-ditch, part of the last-ditch effort to defend the country from both the, you know, the Bolsheviks on the east and the Allies coming in from the west. And some of those boys who were, some of them were only 10 or 11 when they were fighting, were some of the most vicious fighters. Allied soldiers who wrote about their experiences, you know, described how incredibly devoted they were and absolutely willing to die for their country. And so by the end, Germany was really relying on these boys and on the older men who were part of the Volkssturm, which was sort of the civilian forces marshaled at the last minute to try and defend the border, east and west, from the attacks coming in. Germany was reduced to relying on, you know, wounded veterans, old men, and very young boys. And the young boys in particular were so deeply indoctrinated that I think the end of the war and finding out what actually had been happening was absolutely devastating, because everything they'd been raised to believe, everything that they believed was heroic and was worth fighting for, turned out to be this horrible lie. And my father's generation in particular, I think, was affected by that and had to grapple with that for their entire adult lives.
Hmm. As we've already talked about, this novel is based very directly on the experiences of your father and other members of his family. Talk about that move from what you know about your father and this experience that he had and others in the family with these fictional characters in the novel, and what the relationship is between the two. I mean, for instance, is Georg in The Vanishing Sky? To what extent is he your father? Or should we think of him in other terms, different from that?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I mean, I think there are elements of my father in Georg, but there are also elements of my father in his older brother, Max, who'd fought on the Eastern Front. You know, there are elements of my grandfather, also named Josef, in Josef, the father in this family. But Etta, the mother, who in many ways is the heart of the story, is much more inspired by my own mom than it is by my grandmother. So there's little elements, including autobiographical elements from my own life. I'm a great lover of Latin and Greek, and so, you know, that found its way in into one of the characters as well. But the wonderful thing about writing fiction is that everything is so oblique. And so there may be these little bits, these little pieces of your own life, or even these objects that inspire you. But the way they find life in the characters is completely unpredictable. And you have no way of knowing when you start the novel where it's going to go, how these characters are going to turn out, what they will do. And that's part of the wonderful, surprising quality of writing, I think. At least for me, that's one of the great pleasures of it, is that as terrifying as it can be to look at a blank screen and think, what am I going to do to fill this thing? Once you start spending time with the characters, that's not how it works. They end up filling it for you because they take you along for the ride. And you just write down what they experience. And so I always liken it to being a little bit like Spider-Man. You know, you're flying through the air, having to go from building to building, and you don't know where your net's going to attach to. So it's exhilarating and it's a little bit terrifying, but it's sort of a wonderful thing.
Mm. We're speaking with L. Annette Binder about her novel, The Vanishing Sky. Can you explain that beautiful title to our listeners?
You know, the title is a funny story because the working title, it had had a couple of working titles when it was just in early draft form. It had taken me 8 years to write it. And then it had the title Mutti for a while, which actually means mother or mom in German. And my publisher said that's going to be a problematic title because no one will know how to pronounce that. And it's, you know, you just need to go back and we need to think of something else that fits with the book. And so I went back to a scene that in many ways is key to the story. It's a flashback that the mother Etta has thinking back on her childhood where she and her classmates had done something really horrible and she was complicit in it. And because that scene was really the heart of the novel in so many ways, I went back to that, and that's the title that came from that scene.
Hmm. So we meet a number of different characters, but primarily four members of this family: mother, father, and two sons. And I must say that the mother, Etta, is such an intriguing and beautiful character. We feel for her on so many different levels and admire her determination to hold it together and hold her family together in the midst of such a difficult circumstance. Tell us what you thought about as you fashioned the character of Etta.
Well, she was the first character, and thank you for your kind words, Greg. That character lived with me for 8 years as I wrote the novel, and then the book was in a drawer for another 8 years. And I thought about her so often as that book lay in a drawer, and it was so easy to come back to finishing the book and revising the book because in some ways she'd never really left me. You know, she always surprised me with her resilience because as difficult as her circumstances were and as limited as her options were, in terms of protecting her family, she never stopped trying. And I think the idea of the resilience of mothers in particular in times of war and hardship was on my mind as I wrote, and she taught me so much about that. And there were moments that were very difficult to write where it was very easy for me just to get completely absorbed in the research. And she, as strange as it sounds, really pulled me out and got me back on track to writing, even though what I had to write was very was a scene in particular that I was avoiding. And so I spent just weeks and weeks researching, you know, Allied firebombing of the city that much of the action happens in, the city of Würzburg. But because she was so, I really had so much love for her as a character, she pulled me back and just said, it's time to write this scene.
Hmm.
And so I think in many ways she is the heart of the story. She's everything else sort of centers and circles around her.
I would like to read a paragraph from towards the very, very beginning of the book, if you don't mind, in which we get a very clear picture of at least one facet of what you've been talking about. So this is referring to Edda, the mother of this small family. She turned the spigot. It was warm in the kitchen, and the windows ran rivulets from the stream, from the steam. She washed the potatoes and peeled them, stopping every now and again to wipe her forehead. It had been 2 years since they'd all been together at the table, 2 years since Max had left for the front, and now Georg was at the Hitler school, and there was no noise in the house and no laughter. Housework was her tonic. It was her company those afternoons when Josef went to drink his beer. She cleaned more now than she had when both her boys were home and making messes in their rooms. She washed their sheets every week and scrubbed their floors and took their feather comforters outside to pound them in the air. If work were prayer, then she was the most devout woman in Heidenfeld. Her house was cleaner than all the others, and she raked the leaves from her garden twice each day. It's so interesting. I remember speaking to an author a few years ago about a book about her own mother, who here in America, years after these difficult years, was a similarly sort of fastidious housekeeper. And it made all the sense in the world playing out here in Lombard, Illinois, or wherever it is that they lived. But I had never stopped to think about somebody during those tumultuous, terrible times being a fastidious housekeeper in the midst of the waning years of the Second World War. And yet it makes all the sense in the world once we read that, although it's still kind of hard to grasp. Did that spring from anything in particular?
I think, you know, with both my parents being German, and I grew up in Colorado, and there were always a lot of Germans, just lots of German people coming in and out of our house. I think I just sort of osmosed some of that. I think that sort of, you know, as stereotypical as it sounds, at least in my experience, the women in particular of this generation, they were just very fastidious. And it's one way of just imposing order. When everything else is chaos, at least you can keep your sink and your kitchen and your house tidy. And you can exert some sort of control over it. And I think, you know, that's exactly what was in play. Later, when Edda's older son, Max, is in the throes of a breakdown and he's in bed, you know, she again, a sick room has its own sort of order. And you open the curtains at a certain time and you bring in the tray at a certain time, even if the patient doesn't eat. It's just reasserting order, because there's so little else in the world that you have control over.
Mm. That's exactly what this woman that I interviewed talked about with her own mother. I remember one line from either the book of our conversation was, there was nothing that she could control in terms of trying to come to terms with what was so difficult, but she could control the wax buildup on her kitchen floor. And you are painting, in a sense, a similar picture with this character of Edda, who is tirelessly devoted to her husband and her two sons, even when both sons, for different reasons, are absent. Her husband, Josef, is a, in a sense, more difficult character, a bit less admirable, but we feel for him. Explain, in a sense, the professional predicament which Josef finds himself in as the novel begins.
Yes, Josef's memory has started to go, And so he has basically been fired from his job as the head school teacher, which is something that just struck him, in a culture that, is very based on prestige and on sort of your profession. I think his losing his head school teacher position was a huge blow. And it also, getting older and seeing that he's not really able to help defend the country against the incoming allies is something that is another blow to him. His faulty memory has kept him from really being able to contribute to the Folkstorm, and it taps into also his feelings of inadequacy from his experiences in the First World War. So he's a complicated character, and it took me a while to get to know him and to get to see the parts of him that weren't as problematic or as contemptible, because he is a fully realized person, and there are parts of him, as prideful as he can be and as stubborn as he can be, there are parts of him that are just admirable as well. You know, his love for his family is there, but it's much more complicated for him. And in some ways, being able to look at the effects of the regime on these four members of the family and how they are affected in different ways was really interesting for me as a writer, because looking at the coverage of Germans during World War II, you either have the sort of individual heroes who, you know, resisted the regime overtly, or you have the people at the rallies who appear to be full-on supporters of this murderous regime, but you don't see the people in the middle who are struggling one way or another to get by, to understand, to resist on a smaller scale. And so inside this family, you do see some of that, because you see the father buying into the ideology much more than the mother, much more than the younger son in particular. And so you sort of see the effects of the regime on people, of just sort of ordinary people, and how different that can be.
Absolutely. I was so struck by one scene described in which Josef, who goes off to drink beer nearly every day, at one point is described as drinking with the other older men who were too old to fight, but who could talk of nothing else. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting. It kind of feels like the sort of scenes we sometimes see with the four old guys in the local Burger King, you know, in a booth, obsessing about or crabbing about something or other going on, and perhaps in many cases crabbing about something as sort of spectators, disgruntled spectators, kind of on the sideline. And in some ways it's almost something a little bit encouraging about imagining a very, very similar scene in the heart of Nazi Germany in the waning months of World War II. There's just, in a sense, something kind of universal about that sort of experience, and maybe frustration that sometimes people of a certain age or a certain station in life feel.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think Josef sort of exemplifies that sort of, you know, he has so much life experience, and yet he's frustrated. And I think his declining memory, as it gets worse, just increases that frustration.
And we have then, of course, the two sons as well. One is Max, and the other is Georg. And as the novel begins, Edda is joyously preparing for Max's return home, an unexpected return home, and we eventually learn of the circumstances of that. Just ahead of his arrival comes a moment in the novel when the radio gets turned on, and this is something that's obviously very, very important for Josef. You write, Josef stood up from the table, he hooked his thumbs beneath his waistband and hoisted up his pants. A moment later, the radio came on in the living room, as high as it would go. It crackled and cleared, and the song began. They played the same songs one day after the next. Explain this scene to our listeners.
Well, the radio for the regime was just a crucial way of, providing propaganda to the population. And so the radio for Yosef is his way of following what's happening, or at least the regime's account of what's happening, and feeling that he's engaged with what's, you know, the war effort. And at the same time, Etta, the wife, absolutely knows that what is being said on the radio and what's actually happening, that there's this huge chasm between those. And even though the radio still talks about, you know, the victory that's to come and everything that people need to do to ensure the victory, she knows what the reality is, and the other mothers in the village know what the reality is, because their sons are leaving and they're not coming back, or they're coming back broken. And so for Yosef, the radio and then later the newsreels, when he starts going to the newsreels instead of going to do his duty at the Folksturm, and watching the newsreels, which still, until the very end, until March or April, still promised, you know, imminent German victory. Things were going to turn around. That's a way for him to escape and also to feel that he still matters, that he's still relevant.
Hmm. It is so interesting to think about that. And at one point, and I don't remember now what you were... I think it may have been one of these radio broadcasts or something that's being described, but where the context that is given is every battle lost was a prelude to the victory to come. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were probably a few people who in their heart of hearts understood that that was simply a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the two sons. And let's talk first about the older son, Max, and what brings him home. Explain to our listeners the circumstances of his homecoming and how quickly the sort of emotional tenor of this homecoming turns.
Yes, he has really, he is in the throes of a breakdown. And Etta's joy at welcoming him back home quickly turns when she realizes that he's not anything like the boy, the young man who had left a few years before. And his condition deteriorates, and as it does, she knows that she has to hide him from the authorities. She has to hide his decline, because otherwise they'll take him from her. I think it was pretty common knowledge among the Germans at that point that anyone with a mental condition was a candidate for being taken away and sent to an institution that in all likelihood they would never be able to leave. They would die in the institution. And one thing that I found out as I was researching for the novel was that this beautiful city of Würzburg in Under Franconia, which is where my family is from and where much of the action is set, had a university psychiatric institute that was actually a center of the Nazis' murderous efforts to basically eliminate anyone with mental illness, with certain neurological diseases. And so these patients went into this psychiatric institute. They were systematically starved there. They were murdered. And then their bodies were sent to the medical school for use in dissection for the students there. And so even though Etta would not have known the specifics of this, the threat that hung over everyone was absolutely there. And so she knew that she had to protect Max. She had to hide what was happening to him, because otherwise he would be taken away and nothing good would come of that.
Mm.
And so that sort of, you know, it quickly turns from joy to concern to really just an absolute overwhelming need to keep him inside and to keep him hidden.
Hmm. There's such a powerful and kind of haunting scene which occurs when the two of them go to church together, go to mass, and Max ends up with expressing kind of a shocking outburst in the middle of this service. It's just one more symptom of his difficulties. But at some point during that scene, you have his mother, Etta, squeezing Max's hand and thinking to herself, wondering for a moment, what those hands had done. And mm-hmm. it points to the fact that her son has come back but is so radically changed, obviously traumatized or disturbed in terrible ways, and yet he is incapable of communicating anything with her about what has gone wrong. And I don't think I'd ever stop to really think about how awful that would be for a parent to have a child where something is terribly wrong with them and there is no way in the moment to really know exactly what. What has Max seen or what has Max done or experienced that has brought him to this really dark, disturbed place?
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's probably true of wives whose husbands come back from the war as well. You know, on any side, this person has come back changed. I mean, he has seen things that someone who hasn't been part of that will never know, even if they, you know, can describe it, and many of them don't, because it's too difficult or it's better, you know, in their minds just to keep going forward. They've been changed by what they've experienced, and the person left behind is left behind in that way too. They're left behind from the change. And so I think, you know, that part was actually inspired in some ways by my mom telling me about my father, who, after he came to the United States, served in Vietnam for the U.S. And, you know, he came back, he served at the height of the Tet Offensive, and he, you know, she wondered what had he seen, what had he done. It was something that he never spoke about either. And so I think, you know, that's a sort of universal thing that anyone left behind sort of is left wondering.
Mm-hmm. Young Georg is, of course, gone because he is now part of this Hitler Youth movement. One of the most touching moments in the book is when, in reminiscing about his initial departure, the excitement that at least to some extent he felt, and certainly a lot of the other boys. One of the things said by one of them is, "There will be rockets," in terms of what they are likely to experience at this Hitler Youth camp. I think you paint this character of Georg so beautifully as someone desperately trying to fit in some ways not fitting in, and in some ways very uneasy about the whole thing. Tell us more about what you thought about in trying to describe this experience of young Georg and shaping that character specifically.
Well, you know, he really, in some ways, I mean, he was inspired by this photograph of my father, but he really asserted himself very quickly and became his own character as someone who's a little bit soft, in terms of, at least he was perceived as sort of soft physically, like he wasn't strong, he wasn't muscular. He didn't fit any of the ideals that the Hitler Youth sort of held up for others to emulate. He loved magic. He loved doing coin tricks in particular, and would just practice for hours and hours. He loved his languages and his books. He was a complete bookworm. Again, something that would not be valued at all at this time in German history, and especially not by the Hitler Youth. And so because he didn't fit in, and yet he also wanted to be heroic, which is something that, you know, the regime really manipulated these boys into thinking they were being. It tapped into, in the most horrible way, it tapped into every child's desire to be a hero. So he was torn. He was absolutely torn because he didn't fit in, and because of his own personality, he had that distance from it. And at the same time, he wanted to be heroic. He wanted to be admirable. He wanted people to admire what he could do. And so I think those conflicting impulses in some ways freed him from the effects of the Hitler Youth and gave him the chance. When the chance presented itself to run, he was able to take it when another boy might not have. Mm. And that I think was really what saved him.
He has one very special friend, in this group, and their relationship is very striking. Without giving anything away in terms of what ultimately happens to this friend, could you just say a word about the relationship between these two boys or young men, and what you were trying to convey there?
Well, I mean, they love each other. You know, I think he absolutely loves this boy named Mula, and admires him and loves him and basically just thinks about him constantly. And it's a romantic sort of attachment that they have. And I think, you know, without giving anything away about Mula, based on what happens to Mula, Georg feels completely untethered. And then, you know, that's another push for him to sort of make a run, because he sees what's coming for all of them. And when he has the chance, he does. He just jumps from a truck and runs.
What is really interesting is his journey then, in terms of trying to find his way back home, and various strangers, complete strangers, that he encounters along the way. Just say a word about what you thought about as you shaped this portion of Georg's journey.
That part of the book was just a joy to write, because he came across interesting women many times who would help him, but who had their own peculiarities, who had their own troubles, and yet still took the time. They knew that he was basically a deserter, and they knew what the consequences could be for him for deserting, especially at that point in the war, and yet they helped him. And told him stories, and, you know, in a lot of ways, he so desperately wanted to get back to his mother, but along the way he met these women who in some ways mothered him and helped him on his way. So that part of the book was just an absolute joy to write.
I appreciate that, and it's so important for us to have an understanding of the kindness that could be exchanged, and in some ways was absolutely necessary in such terrible circumstances. I do want to give you a chance to talk about another remarkable moment in the book, in which we are taken into a part of Edda's house that is like a museum, a warehouse of beautiful and cherished things. Explain what this is.
Yes. By way of background, by 1944 or 1945, in this part of Germany, all of the Jewish residents had been rounded up and sent away to camps already 2 years earlier. Like 1943 was the last roundup in any large number of Jewish residents. And so this is already a year and a half or 2 years later. And Etta's dearest friend from childhood is a woman named Ilse. And so they were together, and Ilse took Etta down to her cellar and showed her these objects, wonderful old grandfather clocks and mantel clocks and, you know, beautiful sterling silver that has to be polished in the damp cellar. And Ilse explained that these were the things that the last Jewish families had left behind, and that Ilse had agreed to care for them until the families came back. And even as Ilse said that, both she and Etta knew it wasn't true. No one was coming back. And on her way home, Etta started thinking about all the people who'd disappeared, you know, the gypsies who were gone, the assistants to the seamstress who also had disappeared, these twin girls who had twitches, all of these people who disappeared, and how easy it was to forget them because the mind adjusted. And then by the end, it was an act of will, really, to remember anything at all. And that is one moment where Etta grapples with everything that's happened and her sort of uneasy knowledge and the tendency to deny what you know. You know, at some level, her mind was able to deny what was happening, but her heart knew the truth. And that was a moment where, even though these people had already disappeared a few years before, Etta had an insight. She had a realization. And then, because of everything else that's happening around her, it gets pushed aside again, and she, you know, has to keep struggling to protect her own family. And I think that sort of denial and that sort of uneasy knowledge, where your heart really grapples with what it knows, even as your mind's able to rationalize things away, that is something that was very much on my mind as I wrote.
In so many respects, this book is, at its heart, a love story. The love of Etta for her two sons, and for her husband, for as difficult as their relationship has begun, and a story of how love somehow endures, even in the face of unimaginable tragedy and brutality. I was left deeply moved and shaken by your novel, again called The Vanishing Sky, published by Bloomsbury, the author L. Annette Binder. L. Annette Binder, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for giving the world this marvelous book.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you for your incredibly kind words. I really enjoyed our chat today.
And here is just a brief portion from L. Annette Binder's novel, The Vanishing Sky. By this point in the novel, Etta's older son, Max, is in a psychiatric hospital, and she has found her way to him, to his bedside. She had nursed her boys through ear infections and broken bones, through spider bites and bouts with influenza and lung infections that lasted for months. She had nursed her mother, too, and her father, sitting beside them and stroking their hands. It was the last thing her parents had taught her, how to sit bedside. She wiped their foreheads with cool washcloths and poured them water from a pitcher and washed and dried their feet. She fluffed their pillows and straightened their blankets, and twice a day she opened the windows so that they could see the sunshine and breathe in fresh air. Sickness brought disorder. It brought fevers and sweats and sour smells. It stopped the clock. Order was the only remedy. Order was a repudiation of the effects of the sickness. In an orderly sick room, the sun rose again and set. The linens were ironed and smelled of vinegar, and meals arrived at noon at 6 exactly. And even if the patient ate nothing, it was enough to see the plates and the silverware set just so. There was a time for reading and for sleeping and for bringing in the trays, a time for opening the curtains and closing them again. And the order worked its way into the patient, just like medicine. One of my favorite moments from this remarkable novel called The Vanishing Sky by L. Annette Binder, published by Bloomsbury.